Welcome to Railway Legends, Myths, and Stories. I'm Kuma, and I talk about trains. This time around, we're going to talk about a certain kind of train. A train often known by the word or phrase, interurban. What in the heck's an interurban? Well, an interurban is a special kind of train. It's more of a way of thinking about a train than actually specific hardware. Although we will get to a very big differences in hardware. Let's look at it. Interurbans came about mostly at the beginning of the 20th century. There were starts of this in the late 19th, but the key to the interurban, the real key, was electricity. Now, what's the big deal about electricity? Well, before that, there were two main ways to move trains, horses and steam engines. Well, the horse car was riding high at the end of the 19th century. I mean, it was riding high all over the world. Horse cars could pull, a couple of horses could pull a lot of people for a long chunk of the day, and were rather economical to operate. Now, they worked very good in downtown areas because they responded good and they didn't take all that much effort. Now, wait a minute, what about steam trains? Well, believe it or not, there were some streetcar lines run by steam trains. That meant they had this little tiny itty-bitty steam locomotive pulling one little coach. And those worked. I mean, a lot of people did that. There was a real problem of trying to put it all into one vehicle because, well, steam engines still took up a bit of room. And the wood or coal and the water, and those needed servicing. So did the horses, but they were a little easier to deal with. Anyhow, we're talking about electricity. And there were the early electric trams, you know, that had overhead wire or third rail or conduit. We'll talk about those another time, but we'll come back to it. Anyway, a lot of cities started putting in electric trams to replace their horse cars. That was great. Tram would run all day long on its electricity. You didn't have to feed it. Coming at night, you pull down the pole, tuck it in, and that was it. Maybe somebody would sweep out the trash inside. That would be nice. Sometimes you'd, of course, have to lubricate the bearings. You have to do that with all of the rail equipment. But you didn't have to feed it. You didn't have to feed or curry the horses. You didn't have to clean out the motor assembly. This is one of those things I want to emphasize. A tram at night sat on its track and did nothing. Now, yes, it would have to come in because it needed a new bearing or one of the axles was broken or perhaps the overhead pole had broken. Those are repairs. But we're not talking about something, if everything worked, outside of checking the bearings and sweeping it out, you did nothing. Guy could just, 10 minutes, 20 minutes later after it comes in, that person could be off, mostly men. You could walk away and it sits until morning. With a steam locomotive, that's not true. As soon as the day ends, it comes in, and while the driver might get to go away, there's a couple of people that are at the engine shed who goes, oh boy, now I got to get to work. They have to let the fire go out. They have to empty out the firebox. They have to clean it very thoroughly because the coal or wood or even oil would build up soot, and it had to be inspected just every darn night. And then, of course, if you want this thing to run at 6 or 6:30 in the morning, well, by God, you had to start that fire up an hour or two before it was going to go. So somebody was out at 4 o'clock in the morning putting the water in, starting the fires up, and getting the locomotive ready to go. Well, these tram operators, somebody would walk in, clock in, cha-ching, and say, anything up special? And the boss would say, oh, no, you take out number 4 and use the Westfield line and off you go. And the person would go over and check the tram and walk around it, make sure nothing was wrong, put in the little key thing that allowed you to make it go. You'd put up the pole and off you would go. I mean, sometimes you'd have to wait for the air to pump up, but that might be 5 minutes. And that's the worst case. Worst case is 5 minutes and you're off. Some of the early ones, of course, didn't have air brakes. They just had a manual brake. I operated one like that. Put the pole up, put the key in, turn it on. 60 seconds, you're moving. I mean, wow. That's really keen. Well, these trams went over big, and a couple of people started saying, couldn't we run this from to the next town? And I said, well, yeah, we could. But to do that, we'd probably need something a little bigger. Well, they made a little bigger tram and ran to the next town. It might have only been, you know, two kilometers away, maybe even less. You know, towns were smaller. And that worked great. I said, you know, that's a great idea. But if we could go 10 or 20 kilometers away, we could make a lot more money. Uh-oh. Money again. Well, they took, and sometimes they took old coaches, sometimes they built them from scratch, and put the motor assemblies on the bogies, the trucks under the wheels under the car, put a power control stand like you would use on a tram, and put a trolley pole on top. And then they'd run the, electric wooden poles, usually wooden, sometimes metal, sometimes, and have an overhead wire. Overhead wire was the most common. We will talk about the fact that third rail and even conduit is a channel in the road. I mean, it's down underneath, sort of like, well, we'll talk about that another day. But for the most part, we're going to be talking about ones with an overhead wire. Well, they built some of these, and holy cow, they were money makers. No kidding, they were money makers, because a tram would an interurban carrying 40, 50, even 60 people only needed two people. Yes, because of the regulations, it had a conductor who went around and collected the money and made sure it was on time, and somebody called the motorman. Again, men. Huh? I've driven one. Okay, would stand up at the front and run the little controller and make it go. Well, a lot of the big railway, you know, the big road, they weren't real happy with these little interurbans because, like, well, that's kind of cheating. Well, matter of fact, they did a lot of things different than the mainline railroads. Now, wait a minute, I'm back up a second. They ran on the same kind of track. Yes, there were narrow gauge and broad gauge tracks on some interurbans, but the vast majority were 1435 millimeter, the same width trackage as the New York Central, the Pennsylvania. Well, the Pennsylvania was actually just a little bit off. It took them a while to finally fix that. The gauges in Pennsylvania were always a little off, but not enough to screw anybody up. There were the runs in the Southern Pacific, you know, and other rail lines around the world, same gauge. Okay, the thing is, these interurban coaches looked like a passenger coach that would normally be pulled behind a steam engine. They were not like a little small tram. They were these big, long coaches. And in some cases, they could hook two coaches together. Well, I'm going to sidetrack here for a second. Many interurbans actually had electric locomotives. Things sometimes called center cabs, sometimes called box cabs, which is just this little small construct with the motors in it and couplers and possibly brake systems, hopefully. Anyway, they'd couple onto freight cars and take them from town to town. They might even interchange them with a mainline railway like the Pennsylvania, the New York Central, the Baltimore and Ohio. Yes, they would interchange the cars because you'd come into a big city like, oh, I say, Cincinnati, okay? And Cincinnati might have an interurban, which went out to Podunk Hollow. And they would drag the boxcars out there, and people would take stuff in and out, put them in, and they'd drag them back. And they would make money from moving freight. So they didn't do just passenger. Many, many interurban railways, electric interurban railways, also handled freight. They moved goods. Now, you might think these interurbans were little, small systems. Well, according to one of the things I found here, not guaranteeing this, but by 1915, mind you, there was something on the order, not quite, but close to 25,000 kilometers of interurban railway operating in the United States. I think that's a little high. I think it's probably more likely North America, because there were operations in Canada and a few in Mexico. But anyway, we're talking an awful lot of trackage. At its peak, Ohio had like 4,500 kilometers of track, and Indiana had practically 3,000. You know, these are pretty good runs for, you know, a state having this kind of... And wait a second, I found this statistic, and this one really impressed me. In Indianapolis, there was the company called the Indianapolis Traction Terminal. Okay, fine. They had this, well, the Indianapolis Traction and the Indianapolis Traction Terminal, that was their main terminal, that's not their fancy name, was a big building, had many covered tracks. They said nine tracks covered. And they had at their peak in 1926, mind you, 500 trains in and out. So like 250 trains came in, 250 trains out, and moved on the order of 7 million passengers in 1926. That's just one little place. This meant that people were getting on daily and using it for commuting. The interurban today, the only what you might call vestige is some of the diesel-operated commuter railways. But we'll talk about this another day. There is a teeny tiny legacy of interurbans even today, and I'll come back to that another time. But right now we're talking about the 1910, 1920, 1930s. The interurbans saw their day all the way to about the 1950s. That's when motor traffic, buses, and lack of investment killed many of the interurbans. Now, I want to make it clear, the interurbans were fighting highways, which were being built with state money and undercutting prices on. Matter of fact, in some cases, a railway was paying land taxes to the state, and those taxes are being used to impound their own land to build a frickin' freeway that belonged to the state. I mean, how would you like it if I taxed your house and then used that money to impound your house and pave over it? I mean, that's kind of sucky. No wonder the interurbans had trouble. But their heyday was the 1920s through the 1930s. They really were their heyday. The simplicity of operation of an interurban was fantastical. I mean, it just, as I said before, a steam railway, you had to have so many people to make the system run. Now, an interurban, a major interurban with lots of equipment, I'll try to get some pictures. I remember one of the few fully preserved tram and interurban places is in Tacoma, Washington. You can actually see the remainders of it and see sort of what it was like. Now, there are new ones, and I'll get back to that another day. But the point was, you didn't need the facilities of a steam railway to maintain these. You needed shops to put them up, but they weren't as extensive. And you didn't need as many people to do the work. And you certainly didn't need as many people to operate it. A lot of it, you know, as I said, it was electricity. You didn't need coal. You didn't need the water. You didn't need to clean it as much. Well, you need to sweep out the cars. But electricity. Now, another side bit to the interurban and the tram service was that many of these were actually built not by railways, but by electric companies. Somebody came into an area, and they would put in, you know, coal-fired power plant, possibly a hydroelectric power plant. There were a lot of those put up, and they had electric power. I said, my gosh, we got more electricity, and we've got people to buy it. What are we going to do? Well, maybe we could build a railway and use the electricity ourselves. Yeah, that's a great idea. So they would build a local tram system. Some of them would build an interurban system. And electric railway, you know, the word comes out. An electric park. I don't know how many towns had trams that ran out to the edge of town to an electric park with, you know, amusement park ride. Hey, this is a great trick. You're paying me to get on my tram to go out to the park to spend money using my electricity again. Woohoo! I'm making money. And these people think, oh, this is great. So, hey, everybody wins. So, there is that option. Now, some of these interurban systems, and I'm going to talk about a couple of them, but I'm going to jump to one that I know a little about called the Sacramento Northern Railway. Now, the Sacramento Northern was an amalgamation of a couple of other smaller railways, but the whole point was I'm on radio, so I don't post pictures all the time, but you can go look up a map of California and find Sacramento. It's the state capital, big city. Well, if you go north of Sacramento, way up to Chico and some of the communities along there, that's how far north the Sacramento Northern went. Well, it bought into some other railways and it went south. How far south? The Sacramento Northern went to San Francisco. What? Yes. By the end of the 20s and 30s, the Sacramento Northern was running electric trains all the way from Chico to Sacramento, down through the Delta area, all the way to the Bay Area. And eventually there was when the Bay Bridge was built, I want to make it very clear, when the Bay Bridge was built, the Sacramento Northern trains could go all the way across the Bay Bridge to this beautiful terminal in San Francisco, which handled local trams, local interurbans, the Sacramento Northern. The Transbay Terminal was amazing. An amazing piece. We're talking about they had multiple trackages up there in Indianapolis. The Transbay had six tracks, as I recall. And they had somebody at a little control tower, literally switching people in and out, and those trains were going, droom, droom, droom. And they came in and came in and came in. Because of all the trackage, they could always let somebody in because there was always seen to be a platform available. And it handled a massive amount of traffic. And when they tore it out, they suddenly found they had traffic jams using automobiles. Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, the Sacramento Northern had to cross a river in the Delta, and it went across on a ferry. No kidding, the tram would come onto the ferry. The ferry had an overhead wire on the ferry, and it would go across, dock, it would clip on a connection so that the power would go through to the little piece of wire on the ferry, and the cars would roll off. Now, we're not talking about a little tram, we're talking about a full-size passenger car, and sometimes a consist of 2, 3, and 4. These would be plain chair cars. Ones with just regular seats, you know. And some were what we call a proper chair car with, you know, big comfy chairs. You'd pay a premium and sit back in comfort. And they would have people on board either provided by the railroad or more often by an independent contractor called Butcher Boys, would come on and sell soft drinks or lemonade or snacks, apples, things like that, newspapers, so the trip could be fairly pleasant. Now, unbelievably, we're going to go north to Oregon. Not Oregon, Oregon. That's how they say it in Oregon. I lived there. Oregon had a system that ran up the Willamette Valley. It wasn't one of the longest, but it did have something in common with another interurban. It had a sleeper service. I am not joking. You could get on a sleeper car in Eugene, and it would take it on one of their night runs. And it one of the reasons it worked is it went from Eugene over to Albany. It sat for, I think, 3 hours, and then they went on up to Portland. It was, a six-hour journey, something like that, between six and seven, with, like I say, a 2 or 3 hour time just sitting still. But for somebody who wanted to do commercial business in Portland, hey, I could, you know, get on the train in the evening on a Tuesday. I would be there first thing in the morning, or I could be a Sunday evening, and be there first thing Monday morning. I mean, first thing Monday morning, go take care of my business with the banks or the stock exchange or with the whoever business typhoons I was messing with. Anyway, and then get back on a train and come back that later that afternoon in the daytime. Or if you're whining and dining till late hours, you could get on that same train and take it back at night and be back in Eugene first thing in the morning. This was a big boon. Now, another railway in the, I do believe that was in Indiana, had a sleeper service, and it ran a much further distance. So, it wasn't unknown for interurbans to have, dining cars, you know. They'd be sort of like, not like an elegant dining place, but more like a diner. You know, you'd go in, there'd be seats, and there would be, tables and chairs, and there'd be a counter, and you'd order things like a hamburger or sandwiches and some coffee, you know, things like that. So it'd be a decent lunch, and you'd have that on the thing. As I once said, in north of Chicago was the prestigious North Shore line with the Electroliners, and they had the Electro Burger. Gosh, I think they should restore the one remaining. I hope they restore it to full operation, because I would gladly go to the Illinois State Rail Museum where it's sitting and ride it around their track, and I would pay $50 to have an Electro Burger cooked on board the train. I would it'd be cool. But I'm like that. I'm odd. So anyway, what we're talking about is that the interurbans were true rail operations. Some of them even crossed state lines. One or two, I believe, were international and crossed into Canada. Canada had some interurbans that ran. So this was an important part of railroading. Now, I do tell you, one of the funny technology things was interurbans were known to dispatch by telephone. Now, you say, whatever. No, the railroads, the mainline railroads, had been dispatching by telegraph since the 1850s. I mean, late 1850s. I mean, when the first time telegraphs became available, the railroads embraced it. And they were still running hand keys, sending messages, all the way up into the, maybe as late as the 1960s. I'm not joking. I am not joking. Some railways were, but the interurbans were sort of poor type railways, and they would simply have a telephone and call the next station, and except for this ridiculous operation in Indianapolis, most of them did not have that many trains, so it was fairly easy to call the next station and dispatch the trains around by telephone. So that was one thing. Another thing was the slight problem of most interurbans ran using direct current, DC. Now, DC was much easier to operate the control system in the tram, in the interurban car, but it did have the problem of requiring more substations to keep the voltage at the right level along the line. Now, some interurbans ran low voltages. I think I found one that was as low as 400 volts, which is really quite low. But 600 to 900 volts was a very common voltage, which is one used today. I'll come back to that sometime. Remember, hey Kuma, come back to that. Anyway, some ran 1200 volts, that was by 1908, and a few systems used 2400 volts. The Michigan United Railways used that. Now, I want to jump off to the side. On long, long runs out in the countryside, many interurbans used third rail. And some of these interurbans had third rail shoe on one of their trucks. And they would also have an overhead pole. One or two of these actually had pantographs, overhead pole, and two different third rail shoes. One for where they were on 1,000 volt or 1,200 volt DC, and another where they were 600 volt. There were quite a bit of variation in technology here, and it didn't all go away. So, I hope I've impressed you that the interurban was a real railway. It operated like any other railway in the fact that it moved passengers, it moved freight. Matter of fact, many interurbans, slowly died under the name Traction. You know, something something Traction Company. Because they were using still the electric overhead wire. They were pulling freight. I mean, two of the last interurbans running were freight operations. I don't know today, but in the late 20th century, the 1990s, there was still a line in East Troy was still moving goods. It's a museum today, but they were still moving pipes from a pipe company out to interchange with another railway. There was a interurban in San Antonio, Texas, that moved beer because there was an ordinance that prohibited steam and diesel on the city streets, and that's where the track was. So they kept running these electric locomotives to pull from this brewery beer, you know. Hey, that's one of those things, Dad. Believe it or not, there's still a lot of beer moved by rail. A lot more than anybody would guess. Although, in most cases, it's the canned stuff. That's not usually tank cars full. Although, tank cars of alcohol are moved all over the place. So, we'll look at it that way. Anyhow, that's my story right now of interurbans. And I belong to the Oregon Electric Rail Museum at Powerland Heritage Park in Brooks, Oregon, and got to run electric trams. I moved an electric 70-ton electric motor, sometimes called locomotive, with two flat cars. Now, I didn't move it a long way, but I did move that. I was the only person on that train, and I was moving it. We were shuffling it onto the one siding we had to clear stuff off. So, 1990s, I got to run electric train in one-to-one scale, electric trains. Well, that's all for right now, and I sure hope you found out something and are entertained. So anyway, that's all for now, and as always, I hope I get to see you on the train. Bye-bye.